Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can your congregation be more attentive to those in the community? In this episode, we discuss leading in a changing culture with Dr. Juan Francisco Martinez, Professor of Hispanic Studies and Pastoral Leadership at the Fuller School of Theology in Pasadena, California. Dr. Martinez is the co-author of Churches, Cultures, and Leadership.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Dr. Juan Francisco Martinez, who is the Professor of Hispanic Studies and Pastoral Leadership at Fuller. He is the co-author of Churches, Cultures, and Leadership. Our conversation today will center on leading in a changing culture. Juan, we're so happy to have you join us for this podcast today. And I just want to begin by addressing the elephant in the room. Many congregations realize the culture is changing, but are not sure how to deal with it. How can congregational leaders help parishioners to understand and deal with cultural changes?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you folks and be with the listeners of this podcast. One of the challenges related to culture change is that we tend to fall into the trap that cultures haven't changed in the past. In other words, we tend to believe or are often, especially if people are kind of in the majority culture, that things are supposed to remain stable or that they evolve slowly. In other words, we recognize change, but the changes are smaller and we can handle them. And so they don't become a problem because even though culture is changing, I mean, we can think about all the kinds of things that have changed in my 60 years of life here in the United States. And because a lot of them have been more evolutionary, slower, we tend not to think about them. So I think the first thing that we need to help everybody recognize is that we've always lived in this kind of change. And that, again, usually the changes that bother us or that are difficult for us to deal with are the ones that seem to push outside of our limits, outside of the spaces where we feel comfortable. So how do we help people? How do we help people understand that? Again, it depends on how open are we to having the conversation. First of all, for some of us, it may be so frustrating that we've shut down and we closed down and we're like the turtle, you know, like the types of turtles that have a hatch on the front, and we just lock ourselves in and we run away from the situation. And so how do we deal with change? We first need to recognize that we do confront change and the different ways that we tend to deal with it. So some of us tend to lock down. We want no change. Others tend to want to force it to be at our pace. We want to try to control it. And others recognize that change is bigger than us and that we're the ones that have to adapt. So we start by helping parishioners understand and deal with the reality that change is part of life. And so then we can start identifying, okay, what are the kinds of changes, for example, that the parishioners have gone through just in their lifetime or in the last 10 years, and which of these they hadn't even thought about because they've been more gradual, or they've incorporated themselves into their lives in ways that they hadn't thought about, and which are the changes, the ones that are creating the tension or creating the difficulty, and usually the cultural changes that create the most difficulty have to do with the other, have to do with people that are different than us, as opposed to the fact that we're all using some kind of a smartphone that most of us don't think about, or that we all have Facebook accounts and didn't even know these things existed 10 years ago. So it's part of identifying and helping us walk through the reality of we live in change, first of all, and then we start identifying what kind of change.
And for many of our congregations today, even if you're in rural areas, more and more people around you are changing, and that becomes very challenging. So are there some ways that leaders in the congregation can better prepare parishioners to deal with the sort of transitioning that is taking place in their neighborhoods? Because it seems what you're saying is that a part of it is recognizing change is taking place in your life all around you. It's going to take place also in your congregations, particularly as newer people move in that may not be just like you. How do we help prepare parishioners for engaging individuals in a way that is hospitable?
Well, I think that one of the things is within the life of a congregation. So, for example, if new, if you will, other kinds of people, people that haven't been historically part of the community or of our neighborhood or, you know, of our place of worship, start participating, can we start building bridges? And one of the easiest ways, you just use the word hospitality or hospitable. How do we create spaces for hospitality? There's all kinds of interesting ways. Can we create opportunities to listen to each other's stories? In my tradition, we talk about testimonies. We talk about how do we talk about how God has worked in our lives? And we have found that one of the ways that we can more easily incorporate new people, be they similar to us or different than us, is to create the space where they can tell their story, be it in a small group, be it in a Sunday school class, be it in some other type of activity, where we start listening and hearing so that we start humanizing the other person, going, oh, that person has also had an encounter with God. That person is in this, has moved into our community because of work opportunities, because of fleeing violence, because of you know, new spaces, because of study. And we start creating a human face and a human reality to that person. And so we start with that hospitality of opening the door, which is something that most of us in our Christian traditions have known, that we come together around the table, that we invite the other into our space. And there we start a conversation. For some of us, hospitality is all there is, but that would start the space for us to be able to get to know the other as a person and not as a stereotype.
And as you talk about
that, would be a starting point.
I was going to say, and as you talk about that, let me pose sort of an unfair question. What type of leaders have you encountered that have been successful in leading sort of change in terms of being more hospitable to those who are different than themselves? And why do you think they've been successful doing this?
Usually, I found that usually the best kind of person is what others have called, and I call, a bridge person. Now, a person that has a foot in more than one world. So often it's a person who's come out of this community, out of this circle, but has had experience in other environments and has been invited, sometimes forced, but is broadened their perspective, that yet understands the world in which the parishioners are in, because he or she has been a part of that world and understands that side of the conversation in a way that if people are expressing certain kinds of fears, if people are expressing certain kinds of misunderstandings or just, you know, I'm lost here, that person understands that, but has also already crossed bridges into other environments. And so can help people think about this differently. So that the people that I found most successful are those who have already done this in other environments. So that it's either people that have already been, that have already grown up in multicultural environments and have already learned the rules of the game, or it's what we call minoritized people, people that have, even in the United States, always have had to live between various cultures. And so it's a part of how they do life. They understand intuitively that you deal with, you know, that there are cultural differences. It's like the young people that grew up in, you know, in a traditional white middle class neighborhood that have Asian friends, and they learn before they even think about it intuitively that when they go visit that Asian friend's house, that they take off their shoes. And so they already come ready without having ever thought about the cultural implications of that. It's just, that's the way they do things at my friend's house. And so therefore, I start drawing into that reality without ever having thought about it, but it becomes part of a second nature where I go, oh, when I go to someone else's house, then I will be attentive to other kinds of differences that might exist because they live slightly different than we do, even though we live in the same neighborhood. So the kind of person that usually can help others is one that has already done it themselves, has already lived it themselves, has already learned it themselves, but is attentive to the reality of the specific nature of the congregation, so that that person either comes out of that a similar kind of environment or has cross the bridge in the other direction. In other words, they may come from a different environment, but they have taken the time to build the bridge into that environment so that they then can serve as those connectors, interpreters, people that then can help them go, oh, that's what this is about.
I really like the sort of the example you use with going to visit and taking off the shoes. And I'm wondering, as we think about that example, I think all our listeners will easily get that because it's something we can really picture and many of us probably have experience. How do we take that example and translate it for people to think about some of the bigger issues that we confront in our churches in terms of hospitality? Am I making sense? You know, sometimes we can sort of understand, well, of course I take my shoes off. That makes a lot of sense. But then when it comes to something in the church that we're confronting, we see it differently. So how do we help them to sort of translate that it's really the same process that you're going through in terms of being hospitable when we do these acts?
Well, my guess is that unless a church is really hunkered down, I mean, unless a church is really kind of, you know, locked the doors and pulled up the drawbridges and done everything, most congregations are involved in their community in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, in many parts of rural America, I mean, refugees are coming into environments where there never had been people, or new laborers, you know, into the Midwest, for example, in the poultry producing regions. All of a sudden, you've got a whole population of people that are coming into work, that most churches have done something to connect with those people. Most churches have provided some kind of support to refugees, have provided some kind of support to the new people in the community, and use those initial contacts of providing support to say, okay, can we set up a time to, you know, to kind of practice this kind of thing? So we have, you know, a whole bunch of refugees from Sudan. There's been in earlier years, but we'll just use Sudan just as a name, as a placeholder, and say, since we've already connected with these people, could we have some kind of activity in a church or in our home where we intentionally let them be our teachers? We've invited, we've helped them, we want them to adapt to our community. We've been their teachers as we've tried to help them understand how to fit into the community. Can we let them be our teachers now and explain to us, how is it that they eat? How is it that they dance? How is it that they do various family life? So that we start going, oh, okay. So now I've started, again, humanizing the other person, going, oh. So it isn't, you know, that they're terrible people, that because they eat in a certain way, they just do it differently. And let's all experiment together. And we start with the simple things. We start with the what we would call the kind of the surface culture, food, music, the kinds of things that are easier to handle before we jump into the deeper things about how we look at the world, how we make decisions, how we deal with conflict, those things which are going to take more work. But we start with those kinds of things that we can see and we can go, oh, yeah, and this food isn't actually so bad either.
You've mentioned a couple of times multicultural, and I'm wondering if you would differentiate between multicultural and multi-ethnic, or if you see them the same, and if you would differentiate, what would the difference be for you?
Well, the reality is that ethnic groups produce cultures. In other words, culture is the unwritten rules that a group of people that have developed together accept as normal. And so we can be in the same ethnic group. For example, people that would be quite Northern European but live in a rural small town would look different than their counterparts who live in a large urban area. Even though they're part of the same ethnicity, their culture is very different because you develop a set of unwritten rules. You develop a set of how we do life together that looks very different in rural America than it's going to look like in a major urban area like DC, like Chicago, like Los Angeles. And so ethnicity has to do with our common framing of saying a we-ness. We recognize each other as we. And so that would be an ethnicity. A culture would be how we do our lives. And so with an ethnicity, you may have various kinds of cultures that may be class-oriented, that may be the rural urban, that will have commonalities because you're in you're a similar ethnic group, similar language, similar kinds of things, similar religious faith or lack thereof. And so there's enough similarities that we can say we, but nonetheless, there's these separate ways that we've lived our lives together, which is culture, how we live our lives together, how we interpret the reality together. And so then when you have people from different ethnicities or also different subcultures, so that a rural person that goes into the city may in fact want to find, if there's a mass migration, they may all end up in a similar kind of suburb where you're still trying to live out the kinds of ways that you've lived in the countryside. But now in the city, yes, well, you can still make some kinds of connections that may be similar, but the reality is that life looks different. Then, the same would happen in the opposite direction if a city person goes into a rural community. So again, we're talking about how people see a we-ness, that's ethnicity, and how people shape lives together, that's culture.
I think that's helpful because I think oftentimes people do use those interchangeably, and the way you explained it really helps individuals to understand really in our congregations, you're dealing with both at the same time.
Yes.
You actually have multiple cultures in most congregations that you're having to try to figure out how to integrate together.
And you often will develop, and there's a sense in which you almost have to develop, if you will, a church community culture. In other words, how are we going to do life together? So we bring our differences, and we hopefully celebrate our differences. We also call our differences to repentance because culture is not neutral. It will both reflect the glory and creation of God and the reality of human sin. So that all cultures will do that. All cultures will have these beautiful things that reflect that we are God's creation, and they'll reflect them in different ways than others. But all cultures will also reflect the fact that we are broken human beings and that we can be pretty raunchy and we can do some pretty awful things. And of course, the challenge happens when we compare cultures is that we usually take the most idealistic part of our culture and compare it to the worst actual reality of their culture. And so we don't compare real and real. We don't compare ideal and ideal. We tend to compare our ideal with their real. And so we always come out on top because we tend to make those kinds of comparisons. It's really hard to say, okay, yes, they also have some very high ideals. And they also don't live up to the ideals. We don't live up to our ideals. Yet our culture has these ideals and it wants to live up to them. Can we recognize that the other person's culture or this other group's culture is also in the same boat, where there are things within that culture that are very reflective of the glory of God and others that not so much. And so then in the life of the church, as we come together, we we bring our cultures, we bring our experiences, we bring how we've done things, and then together we say, okay, how do we draw from the best of this, and how do we do church together? So how do we, if you will, create, as people would say, a corporate culture? How do we create a culture that has to do with how we do church together? In the past, what happened is that churches, and many churches here in the United States, even to this day, I mean, churches as groups migrated, especially from Europe in the 19th century and now from other parts of the world in the 20th and 21st century, is that people have brought their church. And so the church was linked to a specific culture, linked to a specific ethnicity. So, it was, you know, in the past, it was a German Baptist church. It was a, you know, a Swiss Lutheran. It was a Swedish Covenant church. It was this. And so that the cultures overlapped. The culture of the people outside the community overlapped within the church because it was the same people. So there was no need to, other than to specifically focus on Christian faith, there was no need to make any other kinds of cultural adjustments. And so we tended to think that Christian faith, if I grew up like I grew up in a Latino Protestant church in the United States, I tended to assume that the best expressions of Christian faith were those that were Latino and in Spanish in the United States, because that's the way my community was Latino. My community spoke mostly Spanish. My church spoke mostly Spanish and was mostly drawn out of the same community. So we didn't have to deal with the other. And so that's where the challenge comes, is when we do, if we're going to be faithful to the gospel and invite and be open to having others from other cultures, then we have to negotiate that in the life of the church.
And you sort of hit it where the question I was going to ask you, in this negotiation, how do we, like in the church you grew up in, how do you honor that heritage of speaking in Spanish and your style of worship, while at the same time as you have individuals who have moved into the neighborhood who may be different and want to participate? How do you create a balance where you can do both? It seems to me that's the struggle many congregations find themselves in today.
Well, I would say that's going to be the struggle of every congregation. It's just going to look different how it plays out, because it's going to look different depending on how, you know, how the new members have become a part. For example, in our predominantly Latino congregation, most people who are not Latino coming into the congregation usually have married into the congregation, or have connected in other kinds of ways where they were already friends with people in the congregation. So that looks different than an intention, than when we intentionally go out into the community and say, oh, there's a whole lot of people here that aren't Latino and we need to care about this. God calls us to care. And so then that may look different than the people that organically joined our congregation. And so, again, each congregation is going to look different. Each situation is going to look different. But the task is going to be the same one. As we take seriously that God invites us to be an inviting community, hospitable community that invites others to the faith of Jesus and into the community of faith, then we're going to need to be attentive to that other, that person that wasn't part of the general culture that framed this church. And so that concept of how are you faithful to those who are already there while at the same time creating spaces for the new, I would argue that one of the best ways is to be very intentional about naming the joys and the benefits of the culture that gave this congregation life. For example, my first wife, she died a few years ago. She came from Cuba into a Swedish Covenant church. Well, one of the things these older Swedes, they were still singing in Swedish. They taught the Cubans songs in Swedish, but they also learned songs in Spanish. And so my wife used to say, this gave me the space to both honor the culture I came with, but also adapt and adjust to the new reality of being in the United States. So they would sing, their choir would sing in English, in Swedish, in Spanish. And so that was an affirmation both of the past. We have a history. It was an affirmation of the new people. We sing in Spanish. It was affirmation that we have a commonality, that most of us speak English together in this environment. And so they were doing all of these things in various kinds of ways. You know, we could talk about the specific structures, but they were being very intentional about naming and honoring the forebears. And I think that's one of the ways is that we tell as we invite people to tell their story, we also tell the story of who we are as a congregation. And now I get to also be a part of this story.
That was a very helpful image. And I think what struck me is the amount of work it had to take to pull that off and the investment all of them had to have to work together to make it happen. And it seems to me that one of the things that leaders really need to help congregations think about is that sort of an investment and commitment is necessary if we are going to be able to really make this work. I mean, do you think that's a fair statement?
One of the realities of living in a globalized world is that change is happening a lot faster. And that is often part of what makes it such hard work, is that we wish it would go at our pace. And so, for example, a book that I occasionally teach preaching, a book that I occasionally use is called Preaching to Every Pew. And the authors talk about the fact that most people in our pews are going to be facing four different things. And one of the four is displacement. Most everybody in the congregation at some level is going to feel displaced. The new people, because they're learning, but the people that have been in the community and the church are also going to feel displaced because it's changing. And so part of it is just naming that we all feel this sense of not quite fitting, even those of us who have been a part of this for many years, because it's changing. Certainly those who are coming in new are feeling displaced. And so to acknowledge that we're all there, that we're all slightly askew, and that this is where we're all living our lives. And we can dream about a place that where everything used to be stable and everything was hunky-dory, everything worked right, and we understood all the rules. First of all, that place probably never existed. But second of all, that's not where we live today. And so part of helping people become better followers of Jesus Christ is to acknowledge that we live in a world of change. And interacting with people that are different is part of that change. Interacting with technology is part of the change. Interacting with the globalized environment of how information goes from one place to another, all of that is part of change, and we all feel displaced. And we need to acknowledge it. We need to name, and we need to affirm each other in the fact that we all feel displaced in different ways.
I appreciate that, because I think that that language is helpful, and it's helpful for us to think about the fact that it's not only new people who feel displaced, but those who've been with us for a while that feel displaced.
Yes.
As we get ready to conclude this podcast, I want you to sort of put on your God vision eyes and think about, what do you believe sort of the faith communities that are going to do well in the future will look like? Because we are in such a rapidly changing culture, and we see congregations that are struggling. If you could look 5 years, 10 years down the road, what will those faith communities that are doing well, can you speak to what you think some of their characteristics will be that have helped them to sort of navigate through the changing landscape better than others?
Well, this really does jump in. I will not put on the God glasses. Because you know, if you want God to laugh, tell him your plans, tell him the future. So I will suffer no such illusion. But certainly, as we look at churches that are thriving today, and I would look mostly south. I mean, we can find mega churches in the United States, but we have overall the churches in the United States for the most part are struggling, and that seems to be a pattern that isn't going to rapidly change. But we see that the church is growing around the world. And what are the kinds of characteristics that we see in the growing church? And some of the things that to me are key is the churches of the Global South, for example, and of the parts of the Global South that are in the North, the minority churches, those kinds of congregations, are attuned to the concept that God is at work in the world. In other words, do I start from the assumption that God is at work in the world, that God hasn't quit working because the cultural rules are changing, that God is at work and that we want to be attentive to where God is working, so that we as a congregation, our number one goal is to say we believe that God is at work, therefore we want to be where God is. And so we're going to be attentive. We're going to live a life of attentiveness to where God is at work in the world. Which means that also churches that are going to thrive are going to be churches that are going to be open to experimenting, to saying, okay, yes, we've always done things this way, and those ways may have been really, really good. This is not about saying that they were terrible. They may have been really, really good in their time, but we're in a different place. And as we connect with other people, as we connect with what God is doing, as we're attentive to where God is working, we're going to experiment. We're going to say, okay, how can we think about how we do church, how we reach out into the neighborhood, how we connect in small groups, how we think about our mission, our service, our reason for being as a congregation. And we're going to experiment. We're going to say, you know, we never thought about reaching out to this neighbor. We never thought about working with this among this group of people. We never thought about how we would connect to. And we're going to experiment. We're going to see how we can make better connections. And that churches are going to be alive, are going to be attentive to that spirit work. And they're not going to be afraid to say, if we're part of a global church, maybe we can learn from the churches of the Global South. One of the challenges has been for the churches in the Global North is that because mission went out over the last centuries from Europe, from North America mostly, we've sort of implicitly assumed that we were at the center of what God is doing, and that therefore they will look like us, and they will learn from us. We don't really have a whole lot that we need to learn from them because we're at the center. And the way the church is growing and changing, the invitation is to say, wow, we really are part of the global church. What can we learn from our sisters and brothers in Latin America, in mainland China, where it's so complicated to be a Christian, in parts of Central Asia, in various parts of the massive continent of Africa? What can we learn about what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ? And how can we draw from that? And when we have African immigrants in our midst who seem to be attuned to, you know, that vibrancy of the church in Africa, can we invite them into our congregation and say, we want to learn from you. We want to grow. We sent missionaries to you, and our forebears sent missionaries to you. Now we'll accept that maybe God is sending the descendants of the people that heard our forebears to be, if you will, in the best sense of the word, missionaries to us. And then we're missionaries to each other. And we learn from each other and we grow attentive, believing that the Spirit of God is working. And my guess is that that's where we're going to see thriving churches. And thriving churches may not be mega churches. Thriving churches will be alive churches, churches that have a clear sense of who they are, of how God is working, and whether it's 25 250, 2,500, 20, or 25,000 people, they will have a clear sense that God is at work in their lives.
Well, Juan, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time today, and this was just a wonderful conversation.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be with you and with your audience, and I pray that this will be a challenging, helpful kind of podcast.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Connect with Your Neighbors Video Toolkit, providing resources and strategies to help you improve worship attendance. Connect with Your Neighbors is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com. On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we discuss strategies for bringing a missionary mindset to your own neighborhood with Laura Heikes, pastor of Bee Creek United Methodist Church in Spicewood, Texas.
As you go as a missionary, you want to go in as a learner. You want to find community leaders, elders. There's elders in every community. As a pastor of a church, you should find those elders. You should learn the language. There's different ways English language is used in every community you go to. There's differences in the English language among generational usage that you could learn. You want to learn how music is used in that culture, what speaks to people's hearts when it comes to music, and how the church could capitalize on that. Because it may not be your heart music. It may be the people's heart. You need to learn the people's heart music. There's just so many things that you can think about.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.